Any questions from last time? Oh, that's right. You had a test last time. Wow. Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's right. So today we're going to talk about personality. So, what is personality? What do you think? But what do you intuit? So it's this idea of this sort of relatively stable kind of to give you some consistency in your behavior. What do you intuitively think of? Disposition or temperament? What else do you intuitively kind of think of in terms of personality? So you might think of particular dimensions. We call these dimensions of personality. Introversion, extroversion, yeah. I think most of us, when we talk about personality, it's really something that makes us individuals. You know, we have this particular constellation, particular set of relatively stable characteristics that give consistency to our life, but each of us has a unique combination of those characteristics. And so, really, what we're going to be talking about when we talk about personality is a lot about self, really, as a person. Personality, right? It's in the root there. What is yourself then? I am me. All right. What is yourself? Hopefully. Motivation. So your own individual motivations, what motivates you to do the things you do as part of yourself. What else? Yeah. Values and morals that guide your actions, okay. Okay. So your schemas about the world and how those, you remember talking about schemas and cognition, your schemas and how your frameworks for understanding the world influence your perceptions, yeah? What else is yourself? Mostly what you've been talking about is your present self, right? But self really comprises a lot of factors besides just who you are. So memory. Memory has a huge influence on your sense of self, your personality, your sense of identity, right? But not only that, but most of us don't think of ourself as having any connection to the future. But we hold, as part of ourselves, an idea of who we will be in the future also. So it's this kind of, when we talk about stability, it's this kind of things that we normally think of as very momentary are not, we don't talk about that as personality. We're in a bad mood today. That's not who you are, but rather this sort of relatively continuous expression of individuality. And as I said, but it is a very important part of yourself. And so Carl Rogers, who knows what perspective Rogers associated with? Major perspective of psychology, structuralism, functionalism, cognitive, neuroscience, biological. Which one did he associate with? Do you remember? Humanistic. Yeah. So he was connected with Abraham Maslow. And Maslow in the moment. So Rogers said, our ideal self. And who we are is tied into who we think we can be. Remember, Maslow in the Hierarchy of Needs, the ultimate goal is self-actualization, becoming the best person that you can possibly be. Hold on a second. Yeah. So this is experience of time. A more recent conception of this idea of the self as not being rooted in the present, but also being in the future, is the idea of possible selves. And this is from a social psychologist from Stanford, I think. And Hazel Marcus suggests that we not only have a sense of self as who we are, and we also have these multiple possible selves. And so these are both approaches that kind of take the self out of the sort of what we think of as I am what I am, yes. And that's all that I am. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man. And takes it into who we are becoming. Right? Especially college students have possible selves. A lot of people don't see possible selves. You know, they think of themselves as being very change much in the future. But this is going to be an issue in personality psychology, is how much is personality stable and how much does it change through life. So on that note, where is it that yourself comes from? One of the questions that personality psychologists want to know is, how do we get a self? How do we get a personality? Where does it come from? Partly your experiences, right? What else? So there is a genetic relationship. Actually, we're seeing quite a bit. Culture, sure. So your sense of self is going to be influenced by the culture. And one of the things we'll talk about later is the idea of self-esteem, and how self-esteem varies across cultures. All cultures have an idea of self-esteem, but what it means for high self-esteem can be very different in one culture than another. So we talked about experiences, genetics, culture. So natural selection may have an influence in what kinds of personality characteristics. species, yeah. So there's all kinds of, actually a lot more possible influences than that. And as I said, one of the conflicts in is the degree to which self is very stable. We tend to think of that we have that persist over time. But there are parts of ourselves, especially when we think about this idea of possible selves, conceivably very different in the future than they are now. How self changes, people get real traumatic. Display a great deal of resilience. They're able to bounce back from those traumatic events. Oftentimes, into the event. So that's. What we tend to see over time is the changes are quite small. And what you're talking about if we give you a test, and then we test you. You should move closer to the eye. And this is actually, incidentally, I don't see it much here, but I... your money back guaranteed if you improve your scores. Well, who are the people that need the tutoring services most? The people that are getting scores in the average range, or the people that are getting scores in the below average? And statistically, I'd be relatively confident that statistically you're not going to have to pay out a lot of money. So don't fall for that. So yeah, so change occurs. One of the other things that we oftentimes self-esteem and personality, and they're really not really two very different things. When we think of personality, we think more about self-concept rather than self-esteem. Much more transitory, much more changeable. It's not as persistent and stable as self-concept. I'm feeling. About myself. But over time, I don't have that effect. My self-esteem might be affected because it's raining. There's all kinds of real. Overall level of self-esteem, but we can change it quite easily. with some environmental stimuli. But a lot of people's sense of one of the characteristics of self-concept that I am beautiful, and when their self-esteem is threatened, sometimes what happens is they'll start to maybe they're not so beautiful, and so but in general, we separate it into two different things. Questions, ideas? Personality? Measure them very separately. So someone who's very reserved, introverted, self-esteem doesn't necessarily have a correlation. I don't know what the correlation is, but I don't think it's going to be very high, but it might be. I don't know the data. Yeah. Okay. So then the other question comes up, how is it that we're going to scientifically determine your personality? It's one of the main ways, yeah. I've got a little video here that I think it's useful. I didn't plan to show it, but it just occurred to me that it might be useful here. This is a video that is was produced by an undergraduate student, and it's about identity. And I like this video for a couple of reasons. One, because it illustrates the concept of identity pretty well. And second, because I think it illustrates pretty well how that you can demonstrate your topic area outside of typical. Great example of a creative, but also critical thinking, being able to not only. Am I picking up my? Am I? All right. Okay. All right. I was talking in my social cognition class today about attention and how we keeps us from attending to relevant details in our social environment. And I was pointing out that somewhere around 50%, I think the statistics that I've seen, is that about half the time, the typical text while they're in class lecturing, right? So it's just data. Yeah, something I saw on TV. Yeah, what channel was that? Yeah. Never mind. Yeah, I'll leave the interpretation up to you. I'm just giving you data. I'm not responsible for the interpretation. Okay. So anyway, see what you think about this. Oops. Helps if you have sound, huh? Hold on. This happened to me before on this podium. Sound. Here we go. Okay. So. Oh, Oh, that's what happened. Okay. Okay.
This is a safe place, so you can say.
Yeah.
Busy trying to hide that very thing from the world and yourself, which puts me in a bit of a tough spot. Freud's school of psychoanalysis was founded on the idea that clues to a person's identity lay in the mistakes made in guarding it, and that through dreams, free associations, and slips of the tongue, you could find out just who a person was. In his footsteps, a whole cult of people have tried to crack identity through projective tests. The idea behind projective testing is pretty simple. The tests themselves are like a blank screen. they're utterly meaningless, and it's in this total lack of meaning that their value lies. Because in this little projective world, you are the projector, and anything you say or do in response to these tests is supposed to shed some light on your inner self. I guess in this little projector metaphor, we could think of your identity as the film. You don't see your identity because the projector doesn't see what it's projecting until it's on the screen. And your analyst, I guess we could say, is like the audience with, I don't know, like 3D glasses or something. If it sounds like I'm not taking this too seriously, it's because I'm not the only one. There was a time when psychologists bought into this projective testing, but by and large, those days are over. Because the problem with projective tests is, frankly, the very reason people liked them in the first place. They're completely subjective and completely unreliable. Take the Rorschach inkblot test, for example. You're supposed to look at this inkblot, and depending on what you say, it's supposed to say something about who you are. But you could look at this inkblot and say something different every single day. Does that make you a different person? And the analyst, who's analyzing whatever you think you saw, could say that that meant something different every single day. And another analyst could disagree with him and say it meant something even different than that. Can your identity be determined by an analyst? Or this picture? I needed to go somewhere else for my answers. Hi, is this Ann Fisher? I'm the founder of the Yellow Pages. She asked for my name, date of birth, time of my birth, and $30 for the half-hour appointment. The most surprising thing about my time with Ms. Fisher was the extent to which her office perfectly resembled that of my high school guidance counselor.
Because it's daylight saving. I'd say maybe you have a Gemini rising. Would you say this fits? Are you a person that's mind has to always be busy? You're mentally very, you can do this, do that. You have to be mentally busy or you'd be very, very bored.
Absolutely.
Okay. Then you have to get into a field where it's not boring, where there's diversity. you would be a 7 life path. That's the life of the mystic. To me, I'd say you're probably an old spirit that's been around, has talents from other past lives. You chose a creative college because you want creativity in your life, but you also want to make money. Your rising sign is how people see you, and you're a Gemini, which you're two people. You can be very outgoing. You can be very restless. You have to be, they see you, people will see you in different ways. But it's good because when you have to be a certain way for your business, you can do that very easily. But you can also be a great guy and be very outgoing, or you can be very quiet. You can put on different moods. You have a deep side to you. I know you do, even though you appear to be outgoing. You know, I can feel that. And you have deep convictions about things you want in life. You want a nice apartment, one of those expensive ones in New York, and make lots of money. No, I mean extra nice. You know what I mean? Maybe buy a, be wealthy enough in time to buy one of those. And they come like in the millions. They don't come in too cheaply. You know that. But you'll have money in the future because you're going to work for it.
That's great.
But you'll also make the right connections because you can deal with people. That's how I see you.
How do you think this film's going to turn out?
I think it's going to be good. Each person will give you a different idea. I might give you the best because I'm tuning in on your being. You know what I mean? They see you from a different perspective. With me, though, I'm tuning into the person. So I feel like I'm reaching your soul rather than maybe a person that's just analyzing you.
Right.
You know, because I can go within your aura, your feeling. I try to inspire you. I'm seeing all your talents, and I know you have a good future. You're going to make money. And eventually, have money to buy one of those expensive condos or whatever they are down there. Apartments, condos. You're going to make good money. Come on. You don't want to stay out of that swing. I don't know why I get money with you so much. Do you really like money?
I want my money back already.
Well, you will have to drive her once you taste it.
Because
you're going to feel that it'll pay well.
I'm
going to
keep this tape.
Good.
And in 10 years, I'm going to send you a copy of it alone.
Tell me how you made out.
Yeah,
tell me how you made out.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Do you mind if I keep this?
No, no, if you know what I wrote.
I sort of do. What is all this? This is my number.
Yeah, you're a seven, which is, well, this is your number, which is seven, the mystic. That's the mystic.
Okay.
Your sun is Taurus, your moon is Aries.
All right.
Your Venus is Cancer, your Mars is Gemini, and your rising sign is Gemini.
That's great.
Yeah.
How do you come up with this number here? Sorry, and I know we're running out of time.
That's all right. You just take the 5, and you're born on the 11th, and you take 1983. Gee, that is, I did not add that right. I'm off. 1999, didn't it? Oh, God, it's a good thing you asked me.
Uh-oh.
No, that's...
Am I still the...
Yeah, it comes out of 1. I'm sorry.
So I'm not a mistake?
No, sorry. One. See what I did is I didn't see the 3. That comes out, and then you take 18 and 10 is 28 and breaks down to 1. Okay. You are a person that's individual, leader, a leadership number.
How can, so, which parts of the things that you said are different because I'm a 1 instead of a 7?
Like, 7 is a mystic.
Okay. So that's pretty much it. Everything else is
the same. Yeah,
okay.
Same. Let me see if I had hers right. I did it so fast. 1 more. Yeah, she's a 4.
Okay, so I'm a 1. How commonly are people 1s?
I'm a 1.
Oh. And so it was that my quest drifted squarely back to the realm of science. I left off with Freud and projective testing. So let's pick it up again with Carl Jung in the beginning of Objectivism. Jung was Freud's prized pupil, until the two had a little lover's quarrel about the importance of sex in cognitive development. Jung developed his own personality theory, where he assumed that people are either introverts or extroverts, or thinkers or feelers, intuitors or senses, and that the interaction of all those characteristics created distinct personality types. 2 years later, a Washington, D.C. housewife named Catherine Briggs read Jung's book, and together with her daughter, Isabella Briggs Myers, two published the first tests based on Jung's ideas 20 years later in 1943. Isabel Briggs Myers, it should be noted, was the proud recipient of a bachelor's degree in political science. According to their test, the Myers-Briggs type indicator, people could be either introverted or extroverted, intuitive or sensing, feeling or thinking, and judging or perceiving. That last one, judging or perceiving, was a personal addition to Jung's work by Mrs. Briggs. You couldn't be introverted and extroverted, and you couldn't be feeling and thinking, and so on. And the combination of all 4 characteristics makes up your personality. I found a place to take a test online, and I came out at INTJ. Introverted, intuitive, thinking, and judging. That type, by the way, the INTJ, is dubbed the Mastermind. According to several top-notch personality websites I visited, masterminds make up just under 1% of the population. We are natural planners, take charge easily, and fearlessly take the risks we know to be in our best interest. Much as I welcomed this official diagnosis of what I privately suspected for quite some time, I was still a little wary of a test that all began in the 1920s with a housewife and her poli-sci student. 80 years later, the Myers-Briggs type indicator is still enormously popular. 2.5 million Americans a year take the MBTI, and 89 companies in the Fortune 100 currently use it to understand their employees and sift through job applications. It's popular, but the real meat of objective testing, where real psychologists hang out in the objective sphere these days, is in tests like the MMPI, Minnesota's Multiphasic Personal Inventory. In terms of sheer numbers, the MMPI rules supreme, It is the most commonly administered personality test in history, given to some 15 million Americans each year. The beauty of the MFTI is that it's empirically key. Think of it this way. The Myers-Briggs test, based on Jung's work, took Jung's conclusions about who people were, and then made up a set of questions to test for those specific characteristics. The MMPI, on the other hand, is comprised of a series of true-false questions, 567 of them, with no ties to any specific characteristics. From these choice examples, you should see very clearly that these questions are all over the place. Psychologists then compare your answers to other people, and the thinking is that if you answer a question the same way someone else would, you've got something in common. If you answer enough questions the same way a schizophrenic would, for instance, you better watch out for the white ones, because the MMPI is admissible in most courts these days. I took one, and sat in on Professor Mac Oswald's psychological testing course at Skidmore College, where I go to school. Each of us rated our tests on 9 different scales, each designed to key into a specific clinical dysfunction. So a true answer on question number 132 might score you points in the psychopathic deviant category, while a false on 217 might chalk up one for psychasthenia. Here's Professor Oswald summing up the scores.
So I'll stop it there. So what do you think about that?
First, humorous.
It's very well done, yeah. It's called, the movie is called I, a short film by Chris Ladd, L-A-D-D. If you want to watch the rest of it on the internet, I'm sure you can find it out there somewhere. So I like it, as I said, because he demonstrates knowledge of the ways of measuring personality, but also with the eye toward what the controversies are and what the criticisms of those various methods. Any other comments about that? Yeah. Any? No? Okay, so we'll continue on here. So we talked about what is yourself, your identity, where does it, how might we measure these things? And so currently, you know, the MMPI is actually quite useful. It was originally developed, I think, during World War II. One of the problems that they noticed in World War I was when they did a massive draft of all these young men for World War I, they got not only people who were mentally healthy, but also people who were mentally ill. And so the last thing you want on the battlefield is someone who suddenly goes into delusional thoughts that you're the enemy and not the other people, and this person has a gun, right? It's not a good idea. So So the MMPI was developed to as an efficient way to test lots and lots of people for psychological problems, really. The MMPI-2, which was a revision of the MMPI, actually added a lot more normal kinds of scales to the abnormal scales that were originally developed. So it's actually pretty good. It's got good validity, good reliability. It's a reasonably good measure. The MBTI, the Myers-Briggs type indicator, generally not considered to have very good validity. The reliability is pretty good, but the validity of those dimensions of personality and the usefulness of them in terms of applying those dimensions is still questionable. So I've actually took the MBTI for a job interview one time, and they didn't know what to do with my score because I scored exactly in the middle of all the scales. And the way the MBTI is, you're supposed to, you have to be one on the extremes, you know, you have to fall into one of those categories. And I was perfectly in the middle, and so I didn't get the job. Maybe that's why. What's that?
All of the categories?
Yeah, all four. Yeah, isn't that weird? So anyway, I didn't get the job. Probably a good thing.
Showed right in the middle, and you say he always does that. So I wonder if in psychology.
Yeah. It may be that the test is too transparent, that if you really want to try to wind up in the middle, you can probably figure out a way to do it if you're skilled enough.
Well, it's a self-reporting test, so if you want to be in the middle, you can get yourself there.
But the MMPI, for example, even though it's a self, it's actually a self-administered test and self-report, it includes questions that that give you a score that indicate whether the person is actually trying to deceive the test, and so that's one of the values of the MMPI. That's why it's used so often.
The test is like if you pay close enough attention, they're asking the same questions completely differently.
Well, yeah, that's one of the ways that we help control for deception on self-report questionnaires. Is we'll reverse word some of the items. So on one item, it might say, I'm really outgoing and sociable in party situations. And another item, 20 minutes later on the test might say, when I go to a party, I like to, stay by myself, something like that. So that helps to control for those situations, yeah. So I'll start out and just go through some of the perspectives that have been used historically to try to understand personality. And as the video was kind of talking about, was the idea of the psychodynamic perspective being the sort of great granddaddy of personality psych. Freud developed his ideas in the late 1800s, and his idea about personality development was that our personality is a product of unconscious sexual conflicts that we experience as children. And here's what'll happen. You are growing up, and at a certain age, you become aware of your sexuality, and it typically in children will happen 3, 4, or 5 years old. They'll begin to become aware that they have sexual organs and that they provide pleasure. And so what will wind up happening is children will develop attraction and a desire for their opposite sex parent. And what'll happen is, as a result of that attraction, which is unacceptable, right? They will have to develop ways of behaving that will allow them to keep that desire hidden, right? They have to push it away because it's not acceptable, and so they have to keep it hidden in the unacceptable part of the personality. And so one of the ways that Freud suggested that they do that is what's called identification. And what they will do is, as a result of that sexual conflict with the opposite sex parent, they will begin to identify more with the same sex parent and begin to take on the characteristics of the same sex parent. Karen Horney, despite the spelling of her name, said, children, in childhood we do have these unconscious conflicts, but Freud, you're a sexist pig and you don't know what you're talking about. These conflicts are actually social conflicts. Social conflicts in terms of our unacceptable social urges. And so she said it's all about social. But then Jung comes along. These are considered, Horney and Jung, and along with Alfred Adler, were considered the neo-Freudian psychiatrists. They came after Freud. And Jung said, no, it's not these unconscious sexual conflicts or unconscious social conflicts. We have this collective unconscious that all of us share. And this collective unconscious includes something he called archetypes. And archetypes are like roles that we fulfill in society. And you know, he did a huge study of mythology and folklore across the world. And what he found was these archetypes would appear in almost every culture across across the world. And so he identified these basic archetypes and said personality is a function of our unconscious collective experience forming these archetypes. One of the archetypes, for example, is the archetype of the warrior. There's an archetype for the mother. There's an archetype, I can't remember what the others are, but these are our sort of social roles that we fulfill in life, right? Sort of a response to the psychodynamic perspective was the humanistic perspective. And the humanistic perspective came along and said, you know what? It's not unconscious stuff that drives our personality formation, but rather our conscious experience. What we experience and how we go about making meaning from that experience is what's important. We're aware of the experiences, and it's our own individual choice, and it's our free will to, you know, to make meaning of those choices. And so Rogers and Abraham Maslow are in this camp, and Maslow's whole thing, if you remember from the hierarchy of needs, was that we are striving, each individual is striving to become the, to exercise their greatest potential is what the term he used. And so basically being the best possible person that you can be. And so Maslow's whole thing was these are conscious decisions, and Rogers, rather than these unconscious, hidden kinds of things. So the thing here is Freud and the psychodynamic perspective and psychoanalysts had to use this projective testing where they show you a picture and say, tell me a story about this picture. That allows them to get to the unconscious, the stuff that you don't want to talk about consciously, right? And then they can interpret your responses. But in this view, when we started to move away from the unconscious, we could then start to measure personality in more objective kinds of ways, right? And then the current perspective on personality that's most dominant is the trait perspective. And this is the notion that we respond to our environment. This is a very functionalist approach, right? Remember structuralism, functionalism. Functionalism being I look at behavior as an adaptation to the environment. It's very Darwinian natural selection. And so Allport said, we are part of a social and physical environment, and our personalities are the ways that we make dynamic, you know, changeable, organized, it's not random, but it follows a pattern, adjustments to our environments. And this is going to become the dominant perspective. In fact, when you look at the definition for personality disorders as a mental illness, one of the primary features of a personality disorder and mental illness is that the person can't adapt appropriately to their environmental changes. When you know, when they go to work, they have a hard time changing their personality because all of us have different sort of different really minor differences in personality, depending on what kind of situation we're in. You know, your behavior and your attitudes are quite different, for example, at a party with people your age versus, you know, at a dinner with your parents, maybe. So these are ways that we adapt. And Allport said these organized and dynamic adjustments that we make are really traits on our personality. And so we move a little bit in each trait to adapt to the situation that we need, that we need to. Overall, questions on the perspectives and approaches before we get into some of these in detail? Are there still psychoanalysts? Yes, and there are training centers around the world that do training for psychoanalysis. It's a relatively minor part of the mental health practice field. For the most part, psychoanalysis, at least classic psychoanalysis, I don't know if it's been changed over time. One of the things with psychoanalysis is you had to go like once or twice a week and, you know, for an hour. And you would usually go for years and years and years on end. And as you can imagine, with the rise of managed care, insurance companies becoming much more involved in decisions about patient care and what kinds of treatments they'll get. They're not too happy about a treatment that's going to go for years and years twice a week for $100 an hour, right? So so with managed care, the more common treatments now are more focused and shorter duration, oftentimes a specified duration of 10 to 15, 20 sessions, something like that. Yeah, psychoanalysis by its very nature was very murky and long-term and undefined and because, you know, you couldn't predict where this was going to go. Where the person's unconscious was going to take you. So, yeah. It was very popular in cities, less so in rural areas. But that's true for all mental health, I think. It's more likely that you'll seek mental health care. Other questions? No? It's about 4. You want to take a break till about 10 after? And then we'll talk about psychodynamic stuff.
So when do we get our test back?
Oh, I already talked about this. So let's talk a little bit about psychodynamic ideas about personality. And as I said, the fundamental feature of the psychodynamic perspective is that we have these unconscious conflicts, these conflicts that exist that are below our sort of level of conscious awareness. And so, you know, if you're taking a test and you ever see psychodynamic, unconscious, psychoanalysis, Freud, those are all part of that that general conception. So this is one of the keys that you're going to be dealing with the psychodynamic perspective, that there's something unconscious going on, something that is below the level of awareness. And Freud proposed that personality is constructed by the intersection of a couple of forces. He called one of those forces the id. And the id is all about satisfying these unacceptable, erotic, lustful urges, right? And these things have to stay in the unconscious because they're unacceptable to, you know, civilized people, right? And so, and he'll say that, you know, that we have these desires and the id wants to satisfy that regardless of what the consequences might be. But he also said that another part of our personality was called the superego. And the superego says, look, we're part of this social, you know, this social network, and we need to act in socially acceptable ways. We can't go around satisfying our lustful urges on a whim. We have to establish, you know, respectable relationships. And so what's going to happen is there's going to be a conflict, this unconscious conflict between the id and the superego. And somebody has to satisfy both of these masters. This is the words that Freud used, that we have these two masters and they can't be served simultaneously. And so it's essentially going to be that you're going to get squeezed on both sides. And he said it's the job of the ego, and ego is used in the psychodynamic perspective differently than we use it in common parlance today. You know, we talk about your ego being, you know, your sort of your self-confidence or your self-absorption, maybe. And it was a very different meaning then. It was, the ego was really the fundamental sense of self or identity. And he said the ego's job is to mediate, to come between those two demands and try and figure out how it's going to compromise between the needs of the id and the needs of the superego. So, any questions on that? Pretty straightforward stuff. Of course, one of the problems is that it's very difficult to measure id, superego, and ego, but that's another story altogether. That's why projective tests instead of objective ones. Okay, so if I represent this to you graphically, here's kind of how it would look. So you've got the id sitting out there. And the id, as I said, is all about these unacceptable urges. And the superego, fortunately, is out there kind of balancing the id. And it's all about constraining behavior in these acceptable ways. And the poor ego has to sit in the middle. Now, here's what Freud says. Most of the time, you know, the ego, you know, if we're not somehow disturbed, the ego is doing its job. You know, it's mediating between this id and the superego, and it's able to manage those two demands effectively. But he says sometimes what'll happen is the ego can't effectively mediate between the id and the superego, bless you. And what emerges from that is anxiety. And this anxiety wells up. And we've got to find some way to deal with this anxiety, because here's what happens. This anxiety winds up becoming a neurosis. And we start engaging in neurotic behaviors because of this anxiety, unmanageable anxiety. A neurotic behavior is like a very anxious-based, somebody who's neurotic worries excessively and argues over petty things, right? It's a very kind of anxious kind of experience. This whole conception doesn't come out of nowhere. The history of this is that Freud was a physician in Vienna. And he went to work in Paris with a guy named Breuer. And Breuer and Charcot in Paris were both hypnotists. And what they had found was that there were these rich Parisian women that would come to them with these very strange symptoms. And they would be what Freud would call conversion disorders, where they converted their psychic conflict into physiological symptoms. So they would get something like, it was called glove anesthesia, where their hand would just go completely numb. Or they would get limb paralysis, where either their arm or one of their legs would become paralyzed and they couldn't move it. Or they would lose sight, or they'd lose hearing. And these bizarre kinds of physical symptoms that emerged without any apparent physiological cause were successfully treated using hypnosis. The problem that Freud had was that you'd hypnotize these women, they'd get better, and then they'd have to come back in a week or two and get the treatment again. And he wanted something that was more permanent. So what he did, what he suggested was that that conversion disorder was an emergence from this ego that couldn't effectively mediate between the id and the superego. And that was these neurotic kinds of disorders. And he called this hysteria. Hysteria. Hyster. The uterus, right? You get a hysterectomy, take your uterus out. This word originates with the Greeks. They were trying to find somatogenic causes for disturbed behavior. And they proposed that in women, what would happen is their uterus would become dislodged and start wandering around their abdomen, and it would cause troubles and problems in behavior. Yeah, it's pretty sounds pretty wacky now, but considering what they knew about biology and medicine at that time, it probably wasn't too wacky. But Freud continued to use that term, although he knew that the uterus didn't wander around. The wandering uterus.
So lead to his belief that their problem was that they were women.
Yeah, so it really, you know, it points to one of the main criticisms of Freud is his sexist approach. All of his patients were women. It's no surprise there. But also, don't forget that, you know, he was all about the sexual conflict. Well, guess what? This is Victorian Europe. These women were running around in an extraordinarily sexually repressive society. And really, it's no wonder that these kinds of things might start to emerge from women that are that aren't able to express themselves sexually. So anyway, that's all Freud's thing. And so what happens is this anxiety emerges. And we don't want to deal with the anxiety. We don't want to deal with kind of the underlying problems here. First of all, we don't have access to the id. It's unconscious. We don't have conscious access to this stuff. We have what he called a preconscious access to the superego and the ego. But mostly, we don't know what's causing this anxiety, which is the id and the superego. So what we do is we use what he called defense mechanisms to kind of try to take care of that anxiety. Really, all it does is kind of pushes it below the surface. And so what'll happen is we use these defenses. And Freud suggested, I don't know, I think he's the psychodynamic perspective has about a dozen of these defense mechanisms. I think your book lists some of the ones that I don't list here, and I probably list some that they don't list. But here's some examples of the ways that they might manage this anxiety. One of those is through repression. Basically, you don't think about it, right? It's like, I'm not going to think about that anxiety, right? You just push it below the surface. Regression, he proposed, what'll happen sometimes is you'll see patients who, when they encounter this anxiety, they actually regress in age to a time when before they had these conflicts. He said reaction formation. This is kind of interesting. Reaction formation occurs when someone takes on a behavior that is opposite of the conflict that exists between the id and the superego. So, for example, someone who maybe is feeling, unconscious, unacceptable sexual urges toward the same sex person, and they don't think that that's acceptable, what they will wind up doing is, as reaction formation, they might begin to engage in homophobic behavior, you know, hate-based crimes or something. He also, Freud suggested that homosexuality was a pathology. He it was abnormal. So, but that's not surprising considering the period that he lived in either. Rationalization. He said basically we try to explain away these anxieties. We try to make up reasons why they might exist that are very logical, but they don't get at the underlying causes and reasons. Projection is kind of interesting. Projection is what happens when we attribute our own conflicts to other people. So when I'm experiencing some sort of unacceptable urge or desire, I will actually turn it around and say, you're experiencing that urge and it's not me. You're the one that's causing the conflict and not my own mind or my own id, right? Displacement. Freud suggested with displacement that if we have some sort of unconscious conflict and we can't directly confront the source of the conflict, typically the opposite sex parent, then what will happen is we displace that conflict and that anxiety by taking it out on someone else around us. So, you know, you're mad at your brother, you kick the cat, right? If it's unacceptable to act against that person. Questions on these defense mechanisms? This is one of my favorite cartoons. It's called Tom the Dancing Bug. Here's a guy sitting at his desk, and there's this big blob sitting on his shoulders. And he says, one morning, something incomprehensible showed up. So his computer says, there were these, you know, students shot at Virginia Tech. He says, I couldn't control it. There was nowhere to put it. It just hung around, pushing down on me. So the death toll is up to 33 from the computer. So I waited until I could learn more about it. And he's sitting here with his wife, and the TV says, you know, the shooter was South Korean. And he says, now I knew I had a place in my life to put it. And so he's stuffing this this blob into this box that says, I hate U.S. policies on immigration. And he says, now I feel back in control. And so he's carrying around his box about hating U.S. policies on immigration. Meanwhile, all these other people are carrying around their own boxes. One of them says, coddled criminals are put back on the streets. This one says, there is too much violence in culture. This one says, we need strict gun control laws, right? So these are ways to kind of displace that conflict because you can't or don't want to or are uncomfortable with dealing with the main source of that conflict, right? Source of that conflict, that unconscious conflict. Okay, so as I said, the psychodynamic perspective involves entirely unconscious conflicts. So you don't have conscious access to these things. And the one of the responses to that was the humanistic perspective. And you remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs from the motivation chapter. The idea that we have to satisfy each of these what we'll call lower level needs in order to ultimately achieve self-actualization. And the humanistic perspective was all about the idea that we make choices in our lives, and those choices we make will allow us to either advance in this hierarchy or go down in the hierarchy. And it's a very sort of, you know, it has this perspective of trying to recognize the free will of each of us. Now remember, this is also coming on the heels of the behaviorist perspective, which said, almost said, and Skinner didn't say this, but the criticism was that it took free will out of the picture. It says, you are a product of the consequences of your behaviors, from your environment. Your environment essentially controls your behavior because of the contingencies of reinforcement. And the humanistic perspective is saying, we have, you know, we are people, we're human beings, and we have this free will, and we make these choices. And those choices result in our movement through this hierarchy of needs. Well, ultimately, he said, the idea is to become self-actualized. And self-actualization means being the best possible person that you can. And he called, what he said up here was, we have these B values. And these B values in people tend to be very grand kinds of values of human rights and dignity and worth. And we're striving to achieve these B values. Someone who is completely engrossed in their work, for example. You know, they love their work. They can't imagine doing anything else. They're totally, you know, devoted to it and dedicated to it. That's someone who's experiencing a B value, he said. So the idea is to get to that point where you're living up to your fullest potential. And I can't resist calling up another one of my favorite cartoons here. This is a boy on a stick and Slither. Some of you have seen this before. This is Boy on a Stick and his buddy Slither the snake. What's the most powerful being you can imagine? A sentient laser, he says. Dang, that beats my idea. What's that? Self-actualized piranhas. Not bad. You deserve a few style points. So anyway, I pick these up, you know, I cruise around reading cartoons and think, oh, that's related to psychology. Okay. So self-actualized piranha. Most powerful being. Here's what happens in this humanistic perspective is the idea here is that our self-concept or our personality is developed as a product of a few different factors. One is that we get positive regard from other people, right? We want to be valued. We want to know that we are valuable in the lives of other people. That's part of this kind of being value, right? Having intrinsic value as a living being. What the humanistic perspective then says is that we get this positive regard from others, but our worth is oftentimes made conditional. Other people make demands on us in order to receive this positive regard. It isn't what they said, which is required for actualization, an unconditional positive regard. You know, what we might, in the current parlance, you might think of unconditional love, sort of. But this is beyond love. This is unconditionally recognizing that this person has dignity and worth regardless of whatever they've done in the past or whoever they are, right? And it's really difficult for this to happen in a, you know, in our current sort of functioning cultures and societies. So it's not a very workable model in terms of trying to explain current behavior, current development. Because the psychodynamic perspective is still sticking around, the humanistic personality psychologist said, when we have this sort of self-concept, which is that we are a really wonderful person, I'm a nice person, and then our actual self behaves in a different way from our self-concept. I'm a nice person, but I just stole Susie's lollipop. And that conflict then, he said, what results from that conflict, this conscious conflict of making the choice to steal Susie's lollipop, is that anxiety. And they said what we have to do then is manage that anxiety by either altering our self-concept or our personality, And it's not a fun thing to do to alter your self-concept that I'm a nice person and say, well, I'm a nice person most of the time, but sometimes I'm not a nice person. So what they said is most of the time people will engage in distortions of reality, like denial. You know, just saying, oh no, you know, I didn't steal Susie's lollipop. I don't know where this lollipop came from, but I didn't steal Susie's lollipop. Right? So in all these perspectives, they're trying to explain personality and sense of self and identity. And both in the concept of these are desirable characteristics and undesirable characteristics, right? Because we've got both. We're not all great and we're not all awful. So again, these are interesting theoretical approaches to understanding personality. But for the most part, they're very difficult to test. And for the most part, they're very difficult to validate and to confirm. So what's going to be required is an approach that's going to be much more objective, that's going to be much more measurable as a science, and that we're going to be able to establish valid and reliable measurements to try to find out about personality. And that is where the trait perspective will come in. And that is where we will stop our discussion. No, I think we can, I don't know. Yeah, we'll quit there. We got to do your exams anyway.